Our thoughts and life experiences line the hallways of our hearts and souls like pictures. Welcome to the podcast where we explore what those pictures look like and the effects they have on our lives. Welcome to Hallways of the Heart and Soul. Episode 4, Quicksand. So one of the things that we want to do here on Hallways of the Heart and Soul is interview people about the most difficult times of their life and to just get what they learned from it and how they made it and if there's any wisdom that they could pass along to others who may be going through the same kind of stuff. And so on this episode, we are going to be interviewing George.
What?
Yeah, and so one of the first questions that we want to ask is, tell us a little bit about yourself, but since George has his own episode
I'm kind of a big deal, if you didn't know.
Yes, episode 2, so if you have no idea who George is, go to episode 2, listen to that glorious episode, and you will know everything you need to know about George. So George, tell us a little bit about the darkest time of your life.
Well, for me, I've had, you know, a couple, just because, you know, I'm north of 30 now and have had some, you know, experiences here and there, and also been married for 10 years. So there's been a lot of ups and downs, but for me, one of the darkest or most difficult times in my life that it was very difficult to navigate was when I was in high school. I believe it was 15. I was 15 years old. And kind of like we said earlier, if you listen to episode 2, you'll kind of hear my journey. But just to kind of backtrack, I was 15 in high school. And for me, I love to, like, you know, make sure everybody's happy and make sure everybody's doing great and laughing and smiling. I feel as if that's like one of my callings in life. And even at 15, I had finally like slimmed up a little bit and I was a little taller, because before I was like heavier and I wore thick glasses. And ironically today, I just got a new pair of glasses that are not as thick. Thank God for technology. But back then, like I had contacts and I felt great. I finally had a girlfriend. I was in the band. So for me, it felt like there was a lot of things going great. But during that whole time, as like it felt like kind of good on the outside and what it looked like to everybody, I was really struggling with how I felt about myself inside. And as weird as it was, because like I believed that, like, hey, if I get all these cool things and if I'm not popular, definitely not popular, but like recognized, I guess is a better word than popular, that my life would be fulfilled. But sadly, that was not the case. And I mean, I was in youth group. I played in the band. My dad is a pastor. Mom's a, you know, works children's. I had friends, you know, good close friends. But at night, a lot of times when I used to go to bed, it would just feel like this, like heaviness would come over me. And, you know, it would be, hey, regardless of how you feel or you think you feel, you aren't worth it. Like, you're not smart, you're not cool, you're not fun. And those thoughts, like, just began to grow. And a lot of times I would find myself like in school, like trying to learn and do all these things. And then just that whispering of like, yeah, you make that person feel good, but you're not good. Or yes, you made that person laugh, or you playing drums helps people like sing at church, but you aren't good. And like, you're all the things that you've done really mean nothing. And a lot of times just that internal battle in my brain and what felt like even in my spirit was just, it was an ongoing battle. And it started getting to the point of where, you know, I was sick and tired of being, like, just sick and tired. And a lot of some that stuff would kind of manifest itself in, like, panic attacks. Sometimes I would just, you know, either be at church sometimes or even be in school. And then all of a sudden I would just, I mean, it wasn't like an outburst, but my senses would just be like ready to freak out just because from lack of sleep and all this like heaviness kind of weighing on me, it was starting to run its toll. And for me, it was the option started to get less and less of how do I get out of it? Do I talk to someone or do I try and explain something to this or whatever? And the other option was like, if you want the voices or the heaviness and all that stuff to stop, then you should just like check out. And at first I was like, oh wait, you know, that's too extreme. You know, I'll be missed. You know, people care about me and all these things. And, you know, it kept going on and it was just like, you know, you won't be missed. You know, they say they care, but do they really care? And then internally, I just started questioning like everything. I'm like, does God really love me? You know, does my parents really love me? You know, do my friends, are my friends being real to me? You know, does even, you know, at the time the girl I was dating, I was like, does she really care about me? Or does she just say she does? And like all that questioning just kind of led to, there were nights that I would have, sadly, like when everybody would go to bed, I would go in the kitchen and like just get a knife and bring it in my room and just like hide it under my bed because I didn't want anybody to see the knife. You know, I wasn't trying to draw attention to myself and, you know, just kind of talk about like, you know, I'm so tired of this inadequate feeling that I, and it literally felt like quicksand, like the more and more I tried to battle, I guess, my thoughts, I was losing that battle. Like the more I tried to kick and move and dig myself out, I felt as if I was going even deeper. Like the only movies I wanted to see were sad movies. The only music on the radio I wanted to listen to was like really sad songs. And I even got tired of, I guess, the facade of like making other people happy. And people were like, hey, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. It's like, you don't seem like yourself, but it's like, yeah, I'm fine. And it was one of those things that even today, I know my wife will kind of, you know, affirm this, is a lot of times, sometimes I'll just wear my feelings sometimes on my chest. And it's like, yeah, you're not having a good day. I can see that. And even back then, it was very kind of evident to a lot of people. But this one day, I kind of, you know, was really tired of kind of fighting the thoughts in my head. And I had the feeling of like, this is really not going to work. And my panic attacks were getting like really bad. And I believe it was, I was in gym. And for those of you that know me, in gym playing basketball, the one thing that is guaranteed for me to happen besides missing a layup is to like roll my ankle. my ankles, I couldn't sell them to anybody because I would always either sprain my ankle or roll my ankle. But this one day at school, in gym, rolled my ankle. And I rolled it pretty bad because my mom had to come and like get me. We go do the whole thing. And by now I'm like A, tired, B, you know, just frustrated. And I don't exactly remember, you know, the exact argument, but me and my mom got into an argument. And when we got home, I forget how, like, the conversation went verbatim, but I think there was the phrase that I think she said, you know, I don't love the way that you did something. I forget how that went. But in my ears, the thing that I felt or thought I heard was her saying she didn't love me. You know, I attributed, like, my actions of being completely disrespectful as a teenager to my mom. And her saying that, hey, you know, I don't love that, or I don't like that, or whatever. And at that time, it was like anything negative, like my brain was like a sponge to reaffirm the feelings that I had about myself of inadequacy. So, like, as a 15-year-old does, regardless, but I really couldn't stomp my feet on the way to whatever. I was really mad and kind of went in my room, and I was like, you know, that's it. You know, I'm done. I had convinced myself that my parents don't love me anymore. And my mom left, I think, to go back to work, and I was at home, and I knew that she had a lot of, like, different kind of medications and stuff like that. So I, like, went in her room, and I found these iron pills. I guess they're for your kidney or something like that. But it was a whole bunch of iron pills, and I got to the point of, like, I'm so tired and I can't win that I just need to check out. And I poured a handful in and just swallowed as many as I could. And sadly, I had the feeling of, like, relief. Like, it's done. You can go to sleep and, like, not wake up. And nobody will miss you. Nobody cares. It's done. So I go in my room, turn off the light, like, lock my door because I didn't want anybody, like, waking me up or anything like that. And I fall asleep. Three hours later, it's around six, like, I shoot up in an immense pain. It literally felt that, like, my stomach had, like, a knife in it. And normally you wake up and run to the bathroom and throw up. But I literally, as I shot up in pain, like, I turned over and just kept telling myself, it's like, you deserve this. You don't need to be here. You don't need to go get help. You've earned this pain, all this. And it started to, like, come out. Like, I started to make, like, physical notes. I was like, oh no. But then it got to the point where, I guess, human instinct kicked in. And, like, I ran to the bathroom and I couldn't see straight. I could not see straight. And I, like, made it to the bathroom and then just threw up all over the restroom. And I believe it was one of my older brothers was just kind of passing through. It's like, oh, are you okay? And you could smell, I guess, the iron since it was so much. And he kind of looked in and, like, called my parents. And they were, like, you could see in the toilet, like, all these pills. And it was, like, and those iron pills were, like, a amber red. So it looked kind of like blood, but it wasn't. And then everybody was like, what did you do? What did you do? And I think mom rushed into her room and saw her kidney pills. And there was, like, there's barely any. And they were just like, what did you do? What did you do? And I was just, like, so out of it. And I just started crying because I was like, I don't need to be here. I'm so bad. So my parents were like, oh no. So they, like, pick me up off the ground and, like, whisk me into the car, and they take me to the hospital. Like going through all these checks and stuff, the doctors come in and they're like, hey, you have to drink this. And I had to drink liquid coal, which tastes disgusting. And it's just to kind of diffuse all the stuff that was going on. And I remember vaguely kind of being able to overhear the conversation. And I heard kind of the doctors talking to my parents, and they said that, like, if you guys waited an hour, 30 more minutes, he wouldn't have made it. His liver would have failed, or kidneys would have failed, just because of the intense iron.
Wow.
And it's so weird because it was, it was almost 20 years ago. And to this day, I'm so thankful for, I don't know what you believe in, whether it's a man god or a physical god or a spirit or something that's out there, decided that it wasn't time for me to go. And, it was just depression, really. And it's sad because it's an unseen illness. And it was very tough. Very tough. You know, so we're looking at these medical facilities that can house him. And I thought that, like, hey, you know what? I'm 15. I got my lesson. I learned it. And, you know, it was a very close encounter. I'm ready to go home. And they're like, yeah, you can't go home. Because after a suicide attempt, you have to be admitted. And the weird thing is, like, as intense of a moment as it is, as I look back now, listening to where I was going to go, that hospital had been known for that's where the crazy people go. And I was terrified. I was like, I got it. I learned my lesson. Please don't let me go there. But they're like, yeah, you need to go here, and you're on suicide watch. You know, they take your shoestrings, you sleep in the hall. You can't have contact with family for 48 hours. It was rough. And it was so weird because it's like, I really need help. And the only people I really trust to help me, I can't talk to. The people you could talk to is even medical staff and clergy. So I was so lucky to have a very powerful and amazing youth pastor who showed up. And Pastor Sam, I love him because, you know, the first thing he didn't come up and say, like, what did you do? You know, the first thing is like, are you okay? And I'm glad you're here. And it's awesome because it was shining light on the lies that I believed, that you are loved, and people don't really care about the wrong that you did. They care about you. And it was great because Pastor Sam was here the whole time. Because I did, like, I was supposed to be there for a couple days, and, you know, you kind of graduate with good behavior to, like, hey, now you get your own room, you know, here are your shoestrings back, we believe, but, you know, you don't want to hurt yourself. And, you know, the biggest thing that really helped me kind of navigate that was my community. Now that my parents know that that's what I was struggling with, you know, And those people around me that knew what I was struggling with, they came around me and they loved me. And, you know, to this day, it's so weird because it's like, I know I can tell this story without crying, but I haven't been able to tell this story without getting emotional just because, you know, if I succumbed to, you know, those lies, you know, I wouldn't have the two beautiful kids that are upstairs asleep. And, you know, we might talk about this in a different episode, but for me, that's even why when we were pregnant with our daughter, I automatically knew what we were going to call her. We were going to call her Grace. Because that's something that God, Jesus, or, you know, whoever you believe in, has showed me. And showed me then. Because, you know, he gave me something I didn't deserve. Yes, she's a fireball a lot, but, you know, she's a beautiful baby little girl. And it's just a way that I even sometimes just remind myself of how good God is to me and how good he has been to me because I'm still here. And the hardest part about, in my opinion, about depression is saying it, because it's a battle of your brain. And if people can't see that physical pain or anything, they don't know you're struggling. But the best thing you can do, and now I know, is continue to surround yourself with community. You know, if I feel super, super down, I can text Zach and say, hey, I'm mad about this or that. And he can be there. And my wife and our small group. But it was a hard time. And there are times as an adult that I can start to get depressed. But I know that if I continue to shine light on it and call it for what it is, it cannot have that stronghold over me.
So, George, what would you say to those who may be struggling with the same thoughts or the same mindset that you had? What would you say to them right now?
Well, the first thing I will say to them, like, if you can hear me, is you matter and you are loved and it's okay. A lot of people sometimes have the mindset of, oh my goodness, I'm depressed. Something's wrong with me. Like, no, you're okay. And you need to tell someone that you care about or tell anyone and let them know that, hey, there's something that I'm struggling with. Can you help me? And, you know, the beauty of living in America or wherever you live in 2018, there's a hotline you can call. There's, you know, suicide prevention websites. But the thing that I know worked for me was I had a community around me. I had Pastor Sam, you know, as a teenager, and him being my youth pastor, he would always, always, like, just speak words of affirmation into me, telling me I'm loved and that I matter. And like I'm saying to you right now, if you can hear me, is you are loved and you matter. Community and your loved ones or people around you that you consider your community are the best way to navigate this disease. Even now in my 30s, sometimes I do still get depressed, and the best thing for me to do is talk about it. Because the more you talk about it, the more you shed light on it, the less power it can have over you. It's easier for you to be quiet and deal with it internally, but that has very bad consequences on the back end. So you're loved, you matter. talk to someone. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I know one thing you said earlier in your story where you said you kept having these negative thoughts. And I know it kind of, you talked about quicksand. The more you tried to fight the negative thoughts, the deeper you got. And what that reminded me of, I've heard Richard Rohr say it, and I read it in a book recently where he said that scientists are beginning to discover that our brains automatically or naturally take negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And those negative thoughts stick to our brains like Velcro.
Oh, wow.
And so what they've also discovered is in order to have a positive thought stick on our brain, we have to, like, consciously accept that thought for 15 seconds.
So it's easier to retain the negative thought, but then you have to, like, put
you
effort.
You have to fight. Yes. Oh, wow. It's a fight for the positive.
Man.
And I mean, is that something that you can attest to?
Yeah.
From that part of your life?
I mean, you know, in my situation being 15 and being a teenager, like the gamut of emotions that one has is ridiculous. So for me, like me telling myself that I don't matter, like, I didn't have to convince myself. It's like I received that very quickly. But somebody, you know, even during my depression, someone coming in said, like, hey, you're awesome, or hey, I think you're cool. I kind of just let that slide off to the wayside because I was holding on, or like you said, like Velcro, it was stuck. And then kind of after that, it's like I said, with Pastor Sam kind of reaffirming me over and over again. That's all. Like, I would hear that over and over again, and then I gradually started to believe it. So I can see how, you know, Rohr's statement or whatever rings true to that.
Yeah, and I know for me personally, it's the same thing. And I mean, there are the times that, like, self-hatred and self-doubt,
yeah,
like, crashes and crushes into me.
Yeah.
And so I understand that it's really, really easy to say, oh, just think happy thoughts for 15 seconds and it'll all go away.
Yeah.
Because there's been times I wanted to practice that after I heard him say it and after I read it. And I was just like, you know, in the heat of the moment, you're like, this is just BS.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to sit here for 15 seconds and say, you know, whatever happy thought I want to think, you know, because, like you said, our brains are naturally inclined to go to negativity.
Yeah, that's very easy. And then, you know, like I said, me being, I can get very emotional. It felt magnified. And I think that's even why it felt like it was happening almost twice as fast. And you literally, I felt like it was like I was by myself, even though I was surrounded by loved ones. Thank God and that we have all these resources that, you know, people can go to. It's great to know that you don't have to do it by yourself if you choose to let people come around you.
As we wrap this episode up, I just wanted to take one more time to let you know that you are not alone. That you may feel like you're like George and quicksand, and the more you fight, the deeper you get. And I just wanted to give you the National Suicide Prevention Hotline if you need it. If you feel alone, you're not alone. That number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. If you need it, call it. Or maybe you have a friend or a pastor, a girlfriend or boyfriend, husband or wife. Don't keep it inside. You are loved and you are valuable. So tell somebody. talk about it, call it out, name it, for your life is valuable and you are worth it.